I hate to have us see it that way. I think the media in the U.S. in particular is quick to frame it as a kind of a new Cold War type situation. What I can say is that, you know, the Wagner Group is playing on anti-colonial sentiment, that's for sure. And so, you know, this, what I saw when I went to the region is, this is a region kind of roiling with the aftermath of colonialism. There is a ton of anti-colonial sentiment directed at the French. And, you know, this is a generation, a young generation, that's coming to terms with that historical legacy and all of the injustice. And, you know, there's so much kind of political and ethnic tensions and rivalries that are kind of a ripple effect of the colonial era. So a lot of the kind of personal grudges and fighting that we see between the political elite are a reverberation of colonial times. And so people are just kind of grappling with that legacy. A lot of people are just honestly furious at this. And, you know, that's a big part of what's going on. So there's a real sense, a kind of popular sentiment of, you know, the French must kind of leave us alone at any cost. And I think people popularly see Russia as, you know, as an alternative, a kind of big power alternative that might be provide a possible, you know, support and ally. But I don't think that there's a lot of action behind that sentiment, right? The Wagner Group has been pretty limited in this kind of Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger region of the Sahel that I'm talking about. It's really been Mali that's worked most closely with the Wagner Group, which has been implicated in human rights abuses and, you know, mass killings in Mali in the name of counterterrorism. So there is that. But so far in Burkina Faso, it's just kind of a rumor that there might be working with the Wagner Group. In Niger, there's, you know, people were telling me absolutely not. They haven't worked with the Wagner Group at all. And certainly the Wagner Group might be able to provide some mercenaries on the ground, but they're not going to be providing the kind of hundreds of millions of dollars in military assistance that the West was providing. So I think it's not quite accurate to see it as, you know, either or. And certainly local governments aren't seeing it as a situation in which they can ally with either the U.S. and its allies or Russia and its allies. They're seeing, you know, people have said to me, like, we're going to use whatever assistance is offered to us. We're going to take some, you know, guns from China and some, you know, military assistance from the U.S. and something else, whatever each country is best at offering, you know, we'll take advantage of that.
Well, Stephanie Saville, we want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, anthropologist whose research U.S. militarism in West Africa and beyond. When we come back, we remember Juan Ramos, the founder of the Philadelphia chapter of the Young Lords, and we'll look at the life and legacy of the groundbreaking Irish singer and political activist Sinead O'Connor. Stay with us.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. Your love. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. But no.
compares to you, the Prince song performed by Sinead O'Connor that shot to the top of the charts. We're going to talk about her in a moment. But first, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago, as we turn now to remember one of Juan's close, longtime comrades, Juan Ramos, a former Philadelphia City Council member, founder and leader of the Philadelphia chapter of the Young Lords. Juan Ramos died last month at the age of 71 after a battle with Alzheimer's. He was just two when his family moved from Puerto Rico to Philadelphia, became active in civil rights in high school, spoke out against racism, police brutality, as well as poverty and housing issues in communities of color. He later helped lead efforts in the Puerto Rican community to defeat Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo's attempts to eliminate term limits. Juan Ramos went on to found and lead the Puerto Rican Alliance, which fought for bilingual education against police brutality, spearheaded a large squatters movement and abandoned government-owned houses, leading to over 150 Puerto Rican families eventually winning titles to those homes. He also served as a Philadelphia City Council member, union organizer, and church deacon. Juan Gonzalez, first of all, our condolences on the loss of your friend. Can you share more about Juan Ramos's life?
Yes, Amy. Well, I think that it's really not possible to overestimate the influence that Juan Ramos had on the social and political and liberation struggles of the Puerto Rican Latino community, but also of all communities in Philadelphia. He was widely respected by people in the halls of power, as well as people, ordinary, everyday folks on the streets of Philadelphia. You know, when he founded the Young Lords chapter in Philadelphia, he and the other people with him, Irma Lopez Salter, Wilfredo Rojas, the others who founded the Young Lords chapter, had a much more difficult situation than those of us who were involved in the Young Lords in New York. Of course, we were organizing in the era of John Lindsay, who was basically a mayor of New York who was a liberal Republican and who did not tend to want to crack down on any kind of dissident movements. However, Juan and the other Young Lords in Philadelphia were facing perhaps the most neo-fascist mayor in American history, Frank Rizzo, who was an ultra-right-wing Democrat who was constantly attacking any kind of dissidents. He had a chief inspector of his civil affairs unit, George Fensel. That was the Red Squad of Philadelphia. They were the ones who stripped the Black Panthers naked when they arrested several of them in North Philadelphia, who beat up a young Mumia Abu-Jamal when he was just a high school student organizing for better conditions of Black students in Philadelphia high schools. And George Fensel was the kind of guy who would go to every single demonstration and personally let any activist know that he knew their first name, he knew where they lived, and he was constantly trying to intimidate folks. The Lords in Philadelphia were firebombed twice in the first year of their existence, and no one ever found out who did the firebombings. So that was the kind of climate in which Juan was able to begin organizing in the Puerto Rican and Latino community at the time, and he had amazing success. Even though I knew him from the Lords, it wasn't until I moved to Philadelphia in the mid to late 1970s that I began to actually work closely with him. And by then, he was leading the fight against Rizzo to stop the charter change so that Rizzo could not remain as mayor for life, a successful movement. And out of that came the Puerto Rican Alliance, which Juan was not only the founder, but the first president of. And there were amazing things that the Alliance did in its time. For instance, he was one of the first people to talk about the Navy presence in the islands of Culebra and Vieques, mostly because a lot of the fishermen who had been pushed out of their homes by the Navy in Vieques had ended up moving to Philadelphia. So there was a large community of former Vieques residents who lived in Philadelphia, and they produced a lot of solidarity efforts on behalf of those of their family members who were still on the island of Vieques. And of course, I think probably the most significant contribution that Juan made was his leadership of the squatters movement. You know, after the savings and loans crisis of the late 1970s, there were thousands and thousands of abandoned homes that were federally owned because HUD had foreclosed on them, but no one was living in them. And so we in the Alliance led a squatters movement to basically for people to break into the homes, to the boarded up homes, and make them livable again, homestead. And we had hundreds of families in those homes, and but the government was still threatening to evict everyone. So we started a whole protest movement. I remember in early 1980, we led an occupation of Independence Hall, the seat of American democracy. I think the only time that Independence Hall was ever occupied by a group of protesters. And with the families and the children and everyone, we sat in at Independence Hall for a day until the police evicted us. But George Fensel was so worried about the bad publicity of arresting children as well as their mothers that they basically put everybody into paddy wagons, drove them a few miles away, and dumped us out in the street again. But then subsequently, I think the most significant civil disobedience action was in April of 1980, when we were still trying to get the titles to the homes of the squatters. And we decided to occupy the headquarters of Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign. At the time, Jimmy Carter was in a tough race against an insurgent, Ted Kennedy, who was trying to contest his nomination for the presidency. And they were neck and neck going into the Pennsylvania primary. And on the day before the primary, we occupied the offices of Jimmy Carter. And back in those days, the offices were key because, you know, all the mobilization of voters was done by phone banking and by the index cards that you had of your preferred voters. This was long before the internet and really before mostly of computers. And so they needed those headquarters. And we had occupied the state headquarters downtown on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia. And so the Carter administration dispatched Bill Gray, who was the dean of the congressional delegation of Philadelphia, an African-American minister, who was actually a good friend of ours. And I'll never forget, it was midnight before the Pennsylvania primary, and Bill Gray meets with Juan Ramos and myself in a little bar a few blocks away from the protest. And he says, look, the White House has sent me down here. They've authorized me to negotiate with you. I give you my word that if you leave the offices tonight, because we need them for tomorrow's election, you will get the titles to your the homes for all the squatters. However, we can't make any announcement. We can't look like we've given in to you, but I give you my word. And I, of course, was not in favor of of just a word. I wanted something in writing. But Juan was much more wise about this. And he said, look, I've known Bill Gray all my life. I trust him. We're going to accept his word, and we're going to pull out. So we did, the families pulled out. The primary went ahead. Carter won the Pennsylvania primary. From then on, he swept Ted Kennedy in the remaining primaries. So I think it was important that Juan had that kind of practical sense. He was a revolutionary, but he also had a practical sense. You want to get things done. One of his other great accomplishments was the development of a children's festival at Hunting Park in Philadelphia, which became an annual, you know, event attended by thousands of people. Basically, a series of games and athletic events and others that became a fixture of the Puerto Rican community of Philadelphia. There's so many things that he was able to accomplish. Of course, beside being a city councilman, beside being an appointee of Mayor John Street in the Street Administration, he was just a wonderful person with an enormous capacity for understanding how you meet the needs of people who are oppressed and in need of organizing. And he's a great loss to the Puerto Rican community. And I want to especially express my condolences to his wife of many years, Ana Sotre, who herself led was a director of a fantastic folkloric dance group for many years in Philadelphia, and to all of the other comrades of his in that city.
Well, Juan, we thank you so much for that remembrance. And again, our condolences. Juan Ramos, rest in peace and power. When we come back, we will look at the life and legacy of the groundbreaking Irish singer and political activist Sinead O'Connor, who's died at the age of 56. Stay with us. Emperor's New Clothes, Sinead O'Connor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour remembering the remarkable life and legacy of the groundbreaking Irish singer, songwriter, political activist Sinead O'Connor, who's died at the age of 56. She was found unresponsive last Wednesday in her London home. Her friend, the musician and activist Bob Geldof, has said she sent him text messages, quote, laden with desperation and despair in the weeks before her death as she coped with the tragic death of her son, Shane O'Connor, by suicide about a year and a half ago at the age of 17. Sinead had four children. This is part of a TikTok video. It's the last video Sinead O'Connor shared shortly before her death.
You know, the way your kid unfortunately passing away, it isn't good for one's body or soul, to be fair. But anyway, look, let's not dwell on that. Anyway, hi guys. Here's my nice flat. Let me see, can I flip the camera? Well, anyway, there's a bunch of flowers my friend gave me today. My nice flat. There is my new Martin Johnny fucking Cash guitar that I am going to write some tunes on.
Sinead O'Connor rose to stardom in 1990 when she released her version of the Prince song Nothing Compares to You. The song was on her second album, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, which also included her own song, Black Boys on Mopeds, about the 1983 death of a 21-year-old black man in London named Colin Roach in police custody after they accused him of stealing his own moped. The police said Roach had died by suicide. The inner sleeve of Sinead O'Connor's album showed a photograph of Roach's parents standing next to a poster of their son. In 1992, Sinead performed Bob Marley's War on Saturday Night Live, then proceeded to rip up a photo of Pope John Paul II on live TV, declaring, quote, fight the real enemy. The move, a protest against systemic child abuse in the Catholic Church, of which she was a survivor, provoked widespread uproar. She addressed her SNL performance days later during an interview with Entertainment Tonight.
Ireland has the highest instance in Europe of child abuse I experienced of myself, and I found his presence in Ireland, telling the young people of Ireland that he loved them, hilarious. At least when I studied the history, I found out that the people who were responsible for telling lies in the first place were the Vatican, who, through permitting the invasion of countries and the destruction and murder of entire races of people in the name of God and for money, and then their subsequent overtaking of the educational systems of all the countries that they went into led to distortion of historical fact.
A week after her Saturday Night Live appearance, Goodfellas star Joe Pesci appeared on SNL and had this response during his monologue.
She was very lucky it wasn't my show, because if it was my show, I would have gave her such a smack.
2 weeks after Sinead's SNL appearance, O'Connor was booed at a Bob Dylan tribute at Madison Square Garden after being introduced by Texas country singer Kris Kristofferson.
I'm real proud to introduce this next artist whose name's become synonymous with courage and integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor was set to perform Bob Dylan's I Believe in You, but as the crowd continued to boo, she responded by singing Part of War by Bob Marley, the same song she sang on Saturday Night Live.
Okay, turn this up. Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior.
A decade later, in 2002, an investigation by the Boston Globe shined a spotlight on sexual abuse and its cover-up in the Catholic Church. Sinead O'Connor was an ally of the LGBTQ communities, marched for abortion rights decades before it was legalized in Ireland. She converted to Islam and started using the name Shahada Sadakat in 2018 alongside the name Sinead O'Connor. She spoke out for Palestinian rights, respecting the Palestinian civil society call for BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, once saying, quote, on a human level, nobody with any sanity, including myself, would have anything but sympathy for the Palestinian plight. There's not a sane person on earth who in any way sanctions what the Israeli authorities are doing, Sinead said. Earlier this year in March, Sinead O'Connor was met with a prolonged standing ovation at the RTE Choice Music Awards when she received the new award for Classic Irish Album for I Do Not Want What I Have Not Got. And judges called her album, quote, a stunning body of work by an Irish artist, scorching with originality and songs that are as resonant today as they were more than 30 years ago, unquote. One of the last photographs of Sinead shows her beaming as she accepted the award and dedicated it to, quote, all refugees in Ireland. For more, we're joined by two guests. Jamie Manson is president for Catholics for Choice, and Allison McCabe is a music journalist and author of the book Why Sinead O'Connor Matters, which was published in May. Her new piece for Vulture is headlined Sinead O'Connor Was Always a Protest Singer. Allison, let's begin with you. Give us that history and your response to her passing last week.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the program. Also for describing her as a political activist. I think that's something that the world is just really catching up on now. Of course, I'm gutted and I'm shocked and really haven't had much sleep since Wednesday, but I'm grateful for the opportunity to join you and to talk about her music and her life and her legacy. Like a lot of the world, for a long time, I knew that her hair was shaved. I didn't necessarily know that that was something that she decided to do very early on in her career, before the release of her first album in 87, as really an act of defiance against the recording label who wanted to market her on her appearance rather than the strength of her music. I knew that she had had a mega hit in 1990 with Prince's Nothing Compares to You, but I didn't know that she was not one of Prince's proteges, and that that was not a major hit in his repertoire before she recorded it and made it into a worldwide hit. I knew that she tore up a photograph of the Pope on Saturday Night Live, but I didn't necessarily know that she was trying to draw attention to the crisis, the child abuse crisis, in the Catholic Church, which we all now know was real. So it really was catching up on all of that as an adult and as a journalist that made me go back and reexamine different things that she had said, the statements that she made over the years, the music that she made, not just up into 92, but really to the end of her life. She continued to make music, and she always spoke out against injustice. And sometimes she didn't say something perfectly. Sometimes her message wasn't always heard, but she never stopped trying. And I think that's really the key takeaway, is that she never, ever, ever stopped trying. And it's not enough for us to now say that she was a brave warrior. We have to be brave warriors, and we have to have those conversations that she tried to spark from the very beginning of her career.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Jamie Manson, president of Catholics for Choice, when she tore up that photo of Pope John Paul II in 1992, you were living in Long Island in a traditional Catholic Italian family. And what was your response then, and how do you assess her life?
Yeah, I was surrounded by men like Joe Pesci, and I had a very different experience, though, of that incident than my family did. I, too, felt called to the priesthood the way Sinead did. And I think what's so important to understand about her is that what she did came out of great love of the church. And she said that in the recent documentary. She felt she had the right to fight this evil because of her love of the church. And she felt she had a contract with the Holy Spirit to speak out, and not to diminish the importance of child sex abuse, but Sinead understood the pervasive harm John Paul II was doing, setting back women's rights by potentially centuries, creating the theologies that developed so much sexual shame. And she understood that this was happening globally. What she was seeing in Ireland had global consequences. And so it's so important to understand, you know, she's like a true prophet. She saw things no one wanted to see. She said things that no one wanted to hear. And she risked everything for that. And she basically lost everything. And a sense of, in terms of assessing the current state of things, it's important to remember that Pope Francis canonized John Paul II in 2014. So it shows you how far we still have to go and how prophetic she really was.
Allison McCabe, we only have 2 minutes to go in this segment, and then we'll doing part two and posting it at democracynow.org. But if you could then talk about the rest of her life, because every aspect was acclaim, praise, pushing the limits, being attacked, but it never stopped her.
It never stopped her. And, you know, she said that what happened on SNL didn't derail her career. She said it re-railed her career because it set her back on the path of what she saw as her calling, you know, as your other guest said. She never intended to be a pop star. That's something that just happened when that song blew up in 90. But if you look at the rest of her catalog, before then and after then, she continues to make music with meaning, excellent music. Music that we really have a lot to catch up on in terms of the issues that she was raising, not just talking about child abuse, but as you mentioned at the top, you know, talking about she was anti-racist, you know, she was speaking out against sexism, she was early on talking about HIV/AIDS awareness, and so many other issues. We could go on and on. I know we don't have a lot of time, but it was all in there. And when I saw that, you know, that was really what inspired me to reframe her narrative. And, you know, now there's this outpouring of love, and my only regret is I wish she were alive to experience that. You know, it's coming now, but I wish that she'd experienced some of that during her lifetime.
Well, in a blog post that was widely shared, the musician Morrissey slammed the music industry, the media, celebrities, and others. He said, "We're hypocritical and cynical for paying tributes to Sinead O'Connor only after her death." He wrote in part, "You praise her now only because it's too late. You hadn't the guts to support her when she was alive and she was looking for you." We're going to end it there, but continue our discussion with Allison McCabe, music journalist and author of the book Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. Her new piece for Vulture, Sinead O'Connor Was Always a Protest Singer. And thank you so much to Jamie Manson, president for Catholics for Choice. We'll speak to you both about Sinead O'Connor and post it at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for paid internships in archive and development departments. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The Polygon Gallery presents the North American premiere of Jeremy Shaw's latest and largest production to date, Phase Shifting Index until September 24th, 2023. Employing various outmoded 20th century media, Shaw presents what appears to be documentary footage as the distant future, creating cognitive dissonance within the viewer's relation to a sense of place and time. To learn more about this event, visit thepolygon.ca. What do you want?